You're listening to The Caring Economy with Toby Usnick, sponsored by Philanthropic Impact.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you are in the world, welcome back to The Caring Economy with me, Toby Usnick. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by a couple who I feel very simpatico with, Andy and Randy Aumann. They, along with their two children, Finn and Aria, took an unconventional route to learning and education and living around the world for almost over a year. Now, Andy, a global leader in strategic communications at McKinsey, is a former journalist and the voice behind a very popular Instagram account, a travel account I encourage you to follow called @4AumannsAbroad, the number four. Randy, hailing from Idaho and ignited by international experiences during his college years, has carved out his path in the tech startup world. But these two impressive careers took a backseat for 13 months as they embarked on an extraordinary adventure, a family world schooling journey across 27 countries and all seven continents. But their story isn't just about ticking off destinations in a map. It's about really redefining education, at least for their family, and embracing cultural immersion and fostering a deeper connection as a family. So buckle up as we delve into their transformative year of exploration. Welcome to The Caring Economy, Andy and Randy Aumann.
Thank you. Thanks. Excited to be here.
If you would, as we do typically with our guests, would each of you, maybe with Andy starting, give us a couple minute overview of your curriculum vitae, where you were born, how you found your way, any bumps along the way, or great mentors?
Yeah, absolutely. So thanks for having us. I was born and raised in San Juan, Puerto Rico. My dad was a lawyer from Idaho. My mom, a cultural anthropologist from Curacao. So I'd say from early on in my childhood, travel and having a global view and feeling a deep sense of curiosity about other cultures and ways of living was pretty deeply ingrained in me. Randy and I met after college while we were both change management consultants at Anderson Consulting, which is the former name for Accenture. And after about 9 months of dating, Randy got an opportunity for a startup in Northern Germany. And so he went there and I was able to get staffed on a client in Frankfurt, Germany. And that kicked off this incredible period of our lives of exploring and living and working as expats across Europe, and really just ignited this travel bug in us. When his work was winding down and my client work had finished, we were trying to figure out what to do next and ended up pursuing a gap year in our early 20s, which is a little bit more of, I think, a traditional thing, at least in some cultures, to do kind of the broke 20-something-year-old volunteering and backpacking. And so we spent about 6 months in Southeast Asia, 6 months in South America, and along the way tried to figure out what we wanted to do next with our careers and with our lives. And I decided I wanted to pursue a career in journalism. So I got my master's in journalism on California's West Coast at USC and became a reporter for a little while at the Associated Press. Mm-hmm. And after a period decided that my path was going to be through professional services organizations, but going back and bringing everything together in communication. So that's been where I've forged the bulk of my career at Deloitte and then McKinsey in strategic and change communications, which really did bring together kind of all the threads of mm-hmm. writing and client service mindset. So that's kind of my path, and I'll let Randy share.
Yeah, his. Sounds cool. Good.
Thanks.
Yeah, so my path started in Idaho, as you mentioned, and then moved to Oklahoma when I was, I think, 12 years old. So started fifth grade in Oklahoma and was raised there, and then went to school on the East Coast. And it was interesting. So I was a real math and science kid in high school. And then I got to university. I went to Princeton and got, my mind was really captured by some introductory history courses that I took. There was really an East Asian survey course that covered, I think, 500 years of East Asian history in, you know, one semester. But it just ignited my love for the world, the complexities within it. And I think the role that history plays in helping you understand how we've gotten to where we are today. And honestly, the role of narrative and how narrative is honestly everything. You know, there's that saying, you know, history is told by the victors, and that's true. And so you have to keep that in mind as you're looking at anything like this. So I really found my love for the world and everything in it ignited at that point in my life. And then it was fostered even more when I went and studied abroad in Germany with it was called Institute for European Studies, IES, back in the mid-90s, shortly after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the reunification of East and West Germany. So it was a really, really special and unique time to be there. Mm-hmm. So loved that, got to practice my German, realized that high school German had trained me well to read and write German, but I couldn't speak it at all. So fortunately, after 6 months there, I figured some of that out. But then returned to the States, graduated. Andy and I met at Anderson Consulting, as she mentioned, and then went from there. So after a couple of years, I got the startup bug, had a friend contact me about a startup that was back in Germany, and spent a couple of years doing that. Then traveled, as she mentioned, and then went back, and she got her journalism master's, I got my MBA. And in the course of that, I thought I wanted to go back into consulting, but it turns out I was wrong. I found, in the same way I found history, I found marketing. I really got interested in the idea of how marketing does the same thing. It's telling stories and narratives, same style that I was doing back in history, back in college. And in the early days, I went and worked at Walmart.com when the internet was still, you know, in its nascency. In fact, we were still a joint venture because Walmart wasn't so sure at that point about this whole internet thing and if it was really going to take off. So yeah, got good experience there, and then found myself back at startups after that. A handful of them in San Francisco, a couple of them here in Colorado. And that sort of led me to where I am now, sort of a marketing and sales guy, generally at startups. Now that we're back, I'm starting to think about all kinds of new things. I'm having that.
Very cool.
Do I want to go back and do what I did before, or do I want to try something different? So I think at this point, I'm trying something different and going to see if I can start my own company here. So
very cool. I respect that very much. Andy may have told you, I also studied on IES, Institute of European Studies, fall semester in Vienna, and then a spring semester in Paris. Also, as you think about your next startup, Randy, I'm wondering, I'm just very much into AI right now. And I think it's, you know, you can't avoid it, but I wonder if you might have a little inkling about something in that area, because that seems to be a real opportunity.
I definitely do. And I think my big question is, there's a bunch of ex-colleagues I have here in Boulder who are doing things that are very deep in the AI space. And so I'm thinking about some of those types of things. I'm also interested in how that exists. When I say deep, it's almost like at the infrastructure layer. So the type of things that an end user doesn't pay attention to, but what makes it all work. I'm thinking a little bit also about how AI fits a little bit more close to the end user, in terms of how it can bring together lots of disparate data sources to help you accomplish simple things in life. And it could be like one of the things I'm looking at now, just at a big picture, is it's a very suburban thing. It's irrigation systems for residential lawns. Technology is 50 years old, hasn't really changed. I think there's a lot of opportunity there with AI and robotics to bring together some interesting stuff. So
yeah, we'll talk offline. I've got some folks to possibly hook you up with. I just actually yesterday taught my fourth course in AI for social impact. And I only deal at a very, I'll say superficial level, because we know how robust it is, but the LLMs, and in particular, what was Bard, now Gemini and ChatGPT. Trying to talk to actually Andy's and my counterparts in the corporate communications and social impact space about just engaging with the technology. Mm-hmm. A lot of hesitancy or resistance. And I find it mind blowing what the opportunities are.
It's a mental shift for sure. I think there's a lot of, you know, people feeling threatened by it, and in some cases, probably for good reason, but it's coming. And
yeah, it's here.
So that's harm it or not.
That's a good tee up for the larger conversation today, because I think we have a more nimble approach than some people because of having lived, worked, studied abroad. So why don't you, if you would, just give us a sort of quick overview of the trip that you and your two kids took, and maybe what it looked like and where you went or how you approached it philosophically.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you want to take that?
Yeah. So I think, as you mentioned, we covered a lot of ground. So 27 countries, 7 continents. That was deliberate. We wanted to move quickly. And the goal, even stepping back just a half a step, the goal of this trip was really to get our kids out of their comfort zone, get our kids out of you know, suburban Colorado, which we love. There's a reason we live here. But it's a bubble. and get them to see the complexity of the world, get them to understand that, you know, people live in myriad different ways and live their lives in ways that, you know, they're not going to see if they stay here. So we wanted to get on the road and see a lot of that. And so that also meant we spent a good deal of the trip in the developing world. So we're in Europe a little bit and in Japan, and those were awesome. But we wanted to show them things that we think challenge them and challenge us. And so I think we felt it was successful. Andy will probably get more into that a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But the idea was get around, go to places like Morocco, go to East Africa, Southern Africa, go to India, spend lots of time in South America, which is always a favorite of ours. And to the extent we could, we wanted to go places where we could communicate with folks and local folks in a somewhat natural way. So Japan, for example, is not a good example of that. But being able to speak Spanish down in Argentina was really helpful. Andy's fluent. I can get by and the kids are learning. But it was enough that, you know, our son could sit and talk to taxi drivers about what was going on in the World Cup. And just sort of engaging in a real authentic, organic way and not always having to work through an English language tour guide, unless you're in a place like India where English is the common language they speak. So it gave us a chance, I think, to try to get, our goal was to get a little bit outside of sort of the standard tour itineraries. Mm-hmm. And, you know, hey, okay, 10 days in New Delhi, you know, what are you going to do? Tick it off the list. More try to do things that were going to help us engage with the local communities, help us ensure our money went back to the local communities, and help us understand just and see how the world operates at a much more deep level.
And your friends, family were all, I imagine, shocked and sort of wondering, like,
yes and no.
I think they're used to us by now. Again, the fact that we did it in our 20s, they were shocked then, and there was a lot of pushback. That it's not, as you know, super common in the US. It is in many other countries, in the UK, in Australia, New Zealand. Like, there's taking that gap year, especially in your 20s, is sort of a rite of passage. But here, especially the first time, to some extent this time, it was a bit of the surprise and like, wow, you're going to step out of the career track. What if this time it was definitely some concern or like, well, you're not in your 20s anymore. You're in your 40s. And what if you can't find another job? How are you planning for that? What are the contingencies? What about the kids? They're going to be totally derailed in their sports and activities and all the things. So we definitely encountered some of that. But for the most part, I think we also got a lot of people saying, wow, that's amazing. And something we've always wanted to do and have never quite figured out how to do that. So we want to follow you and, you know, hear all about it and all the how to's.
Great. And we'll talk a little bit about the book you're working on. I mentioned offline at Harlan, my husband and I were coming back from Uruguay a couple weeks ago on holiday via Buenos Aires. And we met this wonderful couple in their 70s in the lounge and we were chatting and they're just very affable. Long story short, they had sold everything. I mean, everything. Bought a Winnebago and spent 4 years traveling around the United States, visiting all the national parks. I challenged them. I said, well, what about your wedding pictures? Like, what'd you do with that? And they conceded that, yes, they had taken a storage locker for some of these things. And now they finished that year and they've spent now 3 months. They were doing service at a gorilla refuge in, I think, Rwanda. And then a few weeks in Antarctic where they're coming back from. But, you know, I just think it's always inspiring to hear stories like yours or theirs, because we do need to kind of shake things up or think outside the box. And I think what you probably have done for folks, as this couple did, is you also hold up a mirror and you help people understand that maybe they should consider something or think a little differently. So let me ask you this then, when you were doing the mapping of the itinerary, that's one thing, but you've got high school kids, teenage kids rather, who are, you're legally obliged to educate them. So how did you do the curriculum and how did you coordinate that?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'll say different countries and even different states in the US have different laws and regulations around that. And you are 100% legally obligated to educate them. Each area has different set of regulations you just need to be aware of to make sure that you're fully in compliance. So here in Colorado, we're in Boulder Valley School District, and we worked with our school's administrators to just understand everything that we needed to do. We spent a lot of time talking to teachers, understanding the curriculum. Our kids were 13 and 10 when we set off. So it was kind of perfect. It was, we'd been planning for the trip for about 5 years, saving and planning. And that was always the year we had hoped to go. It was the year Finn would be in eighth grade and Aria in sixth. So it's sort of the bookends of middle school, which we felt would be perfect in terms of being old enough to be able to do all the fun adventure things that we wanted to do and really remember the trip, but young enough to keep high school intact and still maybe not have all of the drama that comes with high school. So in terms of planning the world schooling piece, like I said, we met with their teachers and tried to really deeply understand what would be covered in their years if they were home, and then work with the administrators to say, right, we want to craft our own curriculum that'll be really relevant and tailored to where we're going. Sure. So I can give some examples, like, and we ended up doing a hybrid of kind of purchasing materials and then creating our own curriculum. So for instance, with math, we purchased materials for eighth grade and sixth grade that were at their levels of math. And that was fantastic through an online site that the teachers recommended, which had YouTube tutorials, it had tests, it had, you know, homework assignments, as well as rubrics for us to, you know, grade them and everything. And so that was perfect. That mapped pretty exactly. And we knew that math wasn't necessarily something that would just organically come to them through the trip, right?
Yeah.
And
you have Pythagoras in Greece, maybe.
Exactly. Although
we did find an opportunity, Greece actually found an opportunity or two to do some physics because we were jumping off little cliffs into the ocean and we
had Ian and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. And my son was like, well, how high do you think we were? And I'm like, aha, I'm glad you asked. We can figure that out.
Physics and math have the answers to that. So funny you mention it. And so we tried to weave in real world applications of things like math or science when we could, but we knew math was one we needed to bridge in a certain way. For other areas, like for instance, and we both divvied up the subjects. So Randy took a former history major, right? He took history, math, and science, and I took literature, writing, and languages. And so for literature, for instance, we sat down with the kids' English teachers and said, well, what are the texts they're going to be reading and what are the themes you'll cover? Because we want to pick our own books that we would read. Mm-hmm. And so I spent a lot of time researching and picked, they ended up reading 30 books by diverse set of authors, local authors to where we were traveling. So for instance, when we were in, you know, Greece, just to give that example, stay with that. We listened as a family to the Iliad as an audiobook in the car. We rented a car and we drove around the Peloponnese. And so it was phenomenal, immersive way to bring in, you know, literature. And then we were visiting the places that we would hear about and then, you know, going to these ancient sites. And so it was just a great way to bring it all together. And then for languages, as just one other example of the kinds of things we did, we did 2 weeks of Portuguese lessons as a family in Brazil, which again, like Randy said, it just enabled us then that much more to be able to interact with locals, have a little bit of the language. In Buenos Aires, the kids already had a pretty deep sense of Spanish. They had been taking Spanish for quite a while, but we did 2 weeks for them of immersive Spanish. And then the culmination of a lot of it was our son Finn had taken 2 years of Mandarin here in Colorado at his school before the trip. And that was a subject, again, just understanding the laws and, you know, what's required. He wasn't required to bridge that gap because it's an elective course. So he could have dropped a level. He could have switched language if, you know, just like any other kid, he could switch to Spanish when he got back. But he really wanted to maintain his Mandarin learning and stay with his cohort. So Randy and I knew that was a subject we were not going to be able to help him with. And, you know, doing something online like Duolingo was just not going to be enough to bridge a year. So we ended up finding a wonderful language learning immersive program in Taiwan. And so he stayed in Taiwan for a month on his own, lived with a local family, local host family that was organized by the school. And That was kind of the culmination of this incredible year-long world schooling journey where he needed to navigate public transport. He needed to, you know, handle the currency on his own, everything on his own as a basically, he was 14 at that
time. Did you then keep traveling around Taiwan while he was immersed?
We kept traveling. We went around Taiwan, and actually after a few days, we ended up going to the Philippines. Yeah. So once we were comfortable that he was, you know, like moving along on his own, we were like, all right, we're heading to the Philippines.
Like New York parents letting their kids take the subway to school, except you're going like Taiwan and the Philippines.
Yep.
No, we were 2-hour flight away. So it was...
And it's kind of almost that study abroad experience for him.
Absolutely.
In fact, he became super close to two students, one from France and one from Germany, who were also studying Mandarin. And, you know, it was this amazing exposure to being independent and to kind of navigating his way in the world as a, you know, global citizen. And it was tough at times. Like, he stepped on a rat in his homestay. That was a bit of a low point for him.
In his room or in his street?
It was in the shower.
I think it was in the shower. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but you know, all the way to like going out to the arcade and just having these amazing successes for himself. So it's just, that was a cool experience.
Ladies and gentlemen, again today on The Caring Economy, we're really having a fun global adventure with Andy and Randy Ahman, who, in addition to being incredibly successful professionals, took a bold move in 13 months out with their two kids to go around the world and educate and experience the world. I wonder if you might share any sort of the difficult moments or what were the obstacles, if there were, in either the curriculum and the education part, or even in just the life experience stuff.
Yeah. I'd say I can think of, I mean, there were several bumps, but I can think of two. One is sort of ongoing. It's just the experience of being together 24/7 was both amazing. Mm-hmm. And also, I'd say for four people who are probably fundamentally more introverted than extroverted, at times feeling the need to really have our own space. Mm. It's tough, you know, when you're budget backpacking for that long, you're not staying in super spacious, luxurious places all the time or at all. And so I think we just had to be deliberate about carving out time for each of us to, you know, have our own space. And for the kids, you know, teen and tween, they have all the sibling fights and things like that. Mm-hmm. So at times, you know, some of the squabbling and just giving them their own space, we were very deliberate about trying to carve out time for each of the kids to have one-on-one time with us or to do things, you know, in different ways and just make sure that we were listening and talking things through, because otherwise I think that amazing togetherness could become, you know, a bit of a challenge. So that's sort of on the ongoing. I'd say one of the tougher challenges was something that happened to Randy.
Yeah. So that was to me, she's talking about, we were in Jordan. We spent about 2 weeks in Jordan and we were at a desert camp. So we'd gone for a nice hike. It was the evening. We'd had some dinner. It was dark. And while we were having dinner, one of the guys, one of the locals kind of grabbed everybody and was like, "Hey, come on outside. There's a fox. You should check it out." So we all wander outside, check it out. And then right as I'm turning to go back in, I feel this fire in my left foot, like, you know, nothing I felt before. And what had happened, I got hit by a, got stung by a scorpion. Okay. So I've been wearing flip-flops, which I've learned since you don't walk in the desert. And it was just, you know, I'm sure I freaked him out and he, you know, popped me right there. And that was the most exquisite 24 hours of pain I've ever felt in my life. And so with that, you know, it's one of these things where we're like, "What was that?" And the guy's like, "Oh, it was a scorpion." And I'm like, "Oh, do I need to worry? Like, it really hurts badly." He's like, "No, you'll be fine in a couple hours." And then the hotel owner comes over, the camp owner is like, "I'm going to take you to the hospital." I'm like, "Wait a minute. You said I'd be okay. And now you're taking me to the hospital." He's like, "No, don't worry. It's fine. It's fine." But net, after 24 hours later, and after, I think we went to four or five different hospitals. The first one was a little one, but then pain went through the night. I couldn't sleep. We got up in the morning and drove to Amman, which is 2 hours away. And Amman has a big modern, in fact, the most beautiful hospital I've ever seen was this private hospital in Amman. But they actually couldn't help other than to monitor my symptoms because, like vaccines, there's no money in scorpion antivenom. So you have to go to the public university hospital. Right. And so they got me there. The doctors there were great. And in the end, they didn't give me the antivenom because it's got enough side effects that you kind of only want to do it if you need it. And they monitored me and said, you're in pain. We get that. You'll live through that. But you're not having no neurological toxicity. That's what they were looking out for.
Andy, so, is he a good patient?
Yeah, he's all right.
And Randy, is she a good nurse?
Yeah, she's a good nurse. Exactly. The one thing though, she can't drive stick, and we had a stick ship.
So I had to drive a car back
to Amman with my busted up foot.
So. Yeah, that was awful.
What about, since I studied abroad, but maybe even you, Randy, because I'm older than you, what about Wi-Fi? Did that present obstacles along the way with your educational plans and execution or your travel plans or your life, social lives?
I'd say not here and there, but not meaningfully. The one thing we did find is that the kids, particularly from a math point of view, really didn't like doing all of their stuff online on the screen. And so what we would do is then when we were in major cities, the packets we had were a bunch of PDFs. We'd go print out, 300 pages of math stuff and then just carry those around. So that was kind of our workaround. But I'd say, most places we did have Wi-Fi access. We had T-Mobile has good global coverage on their phones. So we used that. That got us basic access, at least in all places. And if there was a place we needed more or we were running up against our limits on T-Mobile, we had basically a burner iPhone, old iPhone that I had from 6 years ago. And we just buy SIM cards and pop them in and you'd be good to go. You could hotspot into those from the iPads and it worked pretty well. We probably have better Wi-Fi in many places than we do here in our home.
And we're also
funny. It's like, you look at it compared to when you both did travel abroad, the study abroad, or when we did our, backpacking in our 20s, when we didn't have cell phones even, going around. It is so much easier to forge connections that are going to last. Having Instagram or WhatsApp, for the people that we meet on the road, you meet people in a different way and forge such strong, life-changing connections in ways that, 20 years ago, we'd lose touch because you exchange like an email, but you didn't even really use it. Now the ability to just quickly say, okay, let's, exchange WhatsApps, let's follow each other on Instagram. And that was really so nice to be able to, not to mention all the things that, having a phone and having access to Wi-Fi instantly. I mean, the ability to navigate with GPS in a foreign place, ability to just put Google Translate. And I mean, so many times in places where, because we really did try to get off the beaten path as much as we could, which like Randy said, where possible, it was amazing when we could learn enough of the local language or, be someplace where we could speak in the local language, but where we couldn't, having Google Translate to just be able to narrate was incredible to help us become closer. So really, cool changes.
Yeah. I'm smiling because when my mother passed several years ago, and when she did, my father gave me a box of all the postcards and aerograms I'd ever sent to her through the years, particularly when I was backpacking through Europe in high school or study abroad. And it's astonishing. I mean, quite emotional in a way that it's just a little bit, it's much more, it's just deeper than Instagram feed or something. And it's tactile. So, and we parsed out every word so carefully because it was limited space on these pre-posted aerograms. Anyway, so
I have to say we did send some postcards just because we remember how much nobody gets mail anymore.
It penetrates.
It's so absolutely. Nice to get a postcard.
It's so much
fun. Absolutely. In my new book, we're talking about connections. And one of the things we point out is the old school ways. You will open up what's in the mail, if it's a handwritten card or letter, more quickly than anything else, right? Yeah. So all these tips and tricks you've learned along the way, you're writing a book about it. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's partly a travelogue memoir of our adventures on the road and partly a how-to. So the focus of each chapter and the whole book really is on that notion of world schooling and the idea that it doesn't have to be on travel of a year extended travel. It can be you know, short trips near or far from home, but the ability to use the world as a classroom and to think intentionally about travel is what the book's about. So it's primarily written through my point of view, but each chapter does bring in a little bit of the kids' voice. So it opens with an excerpt from their journals. And each one, I have like a lot of the curriculum that the books that we read. So each chapter also has book reviews by the kids, a little report card of highs and lows. And it explains what world schooling is, because I think there's still a lot of misconceptions and different definitions for what it is, and kind of demystifies that and then explains how we did it and gives ideas and tips and tricks for how others can do it again on travel of any
and length. Is world schooling, is there an international association of it? Is it an established network? Or if someone wants to learn more, how best to find out?
Yeah, there's a lot of resources out there. It's a great question. I define it as like homeschooling, but without the home. It is really using the world, using travel intentionally for learning. And there's a number of different organizations that are popping up. They're world schooling hubs all around the world, where nomads, people who are traveling, can bring their kids for any number, you know, any amount of time, and almost like enroll them in these hubs. And so that's, you know, one style. There's also a ton of online academies, different schools, kind of, you know, the long tail of COVID still offer remote options. So there's ways to tap into that. There's ways to craft curriculum like we did. So I think that's part of, I think it's definitely a growing trend. If you look at hashtag, you know, world schooling or world school families, they're, you know, hundreds of thousands of followers of those kind of tags. But I think there's so many different ways of doing it, depending on the family and how, you know, appetite for how much to take on, or, you know, so many different things, that there's no single source of truth on how to do it. But I think there's a growing interest and interest in exploring doing it.
So when do you think the book will be out, and how can people find it, or how can people be in touch with you if they want to learn more?
Yeah, they can follow me on at For Almonds Abroad on Instagram, and I'll post a lot more about when it's coming out. I have an agent and we've got our pitch. I just finished the epilogue, so it's just kind of wrapped up, because I wanted to do that 6 months post, you know, reintegration look. So we're shopping it around to publishers and would hope that it would be out next year.
Two last questions. One, I know coming back from traveling abroad, studying abroad, and then becoming a study abroad advisor for both my graduate degrees, that the re-entry is in many ways more challenging than the actual going abroad. And I wonder how it's been for all four of you.
Yeah, I think it's been different for all four of us, I would say. And it's interesting. So I found this time to be very different from when we traveled 20 years ago in our 20s. That reintegration was really jarring. It was sort of the first time I think I'd taken a look at worlds that were very different from America, like Germany when I was there. That's different, but it's not radically different. And so coming back to the States after being in South America and Southeast Asia for a year at that age was really jarring to just see sort of, I think, the bounty that we have here, and how you take it for granted when you grow up here. And so that's helped me have that realization. This time it's almost been the opposite, in that the reintegration has been so smooth, it's been eerie. And I think part of it is because we rented our house out. And so we came back, we moved right back into the same place, same bed, kids are back in the same school, same friends. It's sort of, you know.
Did that happen?
Yeah, you're just
totally.
Sort of like,
is
right,
this a dream?
Is it a dream? Exactly. So it's like one of the things we kind of, I keep doing, you know, a couple times a week, I'll ask the kids over dinner, I'll say, okay, where were we a year ago? Just trying to sort of make them realize that, yes, it did happen. Think about, you know, how much things can change in a year. But yeah, this time around, it's been interesting. We've just kind of popped right back in. The kids have popped right back into school. There's times we look at the kids and say, did they take anything away from this? Because they're just normal teenagers now, with all the teenager junk that they deal with. And we have to tell ourselves that, yeah, I'm sure they did. It's just buried under some layers of things right now.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, coming back, our son was so excited to get his driver's license, you know, permit. Yeah. And he had his first girlfriend, and, you know, things like that are just wonderful, normal things. And I think also part of it, why maybe the reintegration was easier this time, is we had always just planned on a year.
Yeah.
So, you know, we talked about that throughout. We never wanted to be endlessly nomadic. We really do want to give the kids roots in addition to having, you know, helped them find their wings. And so for us, it was just that it really wasn't bittersweet in any way. It was just filled with gratitude that we were able to carve out that time on the road as a family, and then gratitude to come back to a place that we did after all of our nomadic lifestyles before. We deliberately picked where we live in Colorado and, you know, have carved out a life that we love. So in that sense, I think it was, you know, so much easier. But then every once in a while, we do look at the kids and they'll say something like, our son came back the other day. He was working on a history project and he was so excited to tell us about it. It was an like online escape room set in Egypt. And he walked us through all of it. He said, Mom, I almost feel, you know, guilty because I had such a leg up and my team won. But, you know, you're starting off in Cairo and then, you know, it's this map and you're supposed to figure out like, where do you go? And I'm like, well, obviously you would go south to Abu Simbel and the Valley of the Kings is on this side of the Nile. And he was like, it's just so amazing to be able to connect that to what we did. And, you know, we look at each other and think like, yeah, I mean, it's just so much that's there that, you know, they'll draw on for, you know, hopefully the rest of their lives in ways that just, it makes so much more tangible when they do hear about, you know, something that to us, when we learned about it in school, was just this far away.
Yeah. Thing,
like, you know, the Vietnam War, can't even place that. Like they've been there. They've been to the, you know, museums. Yeah. Like, so I think it'll keep emerging in so many different ways over their lives.
Absolutely. They've got the knowledge, the experience, but then they've also got a new way of thinking and a new way of looking at the world. Absolutely. Which is going to ensure, I'm certain, a greater successful life for them. Whatever. I mean, nobody has a crystal ball, right?
Yeah.
Well, and hopefully they can think about, you know, what their role will be in helping it be a better place. I mean, that's one of the things early on Randy talked about, our goals with this trip. And it really was to help them become more, you know, inclusive global citizens and to see all the different ways of working and living and being happy and to get out of our bubble and put away the ubiquitous tech, right? And so, you know, for them continuing to push and say, like, what's going to be the change that you see in the world?
One question I want to ask, I didn't put it in here, but this is about the role of business in society. And I wonder, Randy, in particular, you're going back to McKinsey, it doesn't get much more major than that. Can you say anything about that topic, about not necessarily McKinsey, but what you see and what your kids see of the role of business in society, and you know, maybe give a shout out to your employer or maybe not? I don't know. I don't want to lead the witness.
So I'm super grateful to McKinsey. They gave me a year-long leave of absence to be able to pursue this, you know, passion goal for us as a family. And they're very supportive of different working models. I think as a consulting firm, we do have a lot of different ways that people work on engagements. And so you have opportunities for short-term stints that's called take time in between client studies that people can go and pursue, you know, a learning course and something they're just super interested in, or, you know, just take time. And so for me, I think that's been incredibly meaningful. And as I come back into my role, it's a role that I love, leading a team of communications professionals. I'm also looking at ways to continue to foster this passion that I have around learning and education for others. And so I'm starting to get deeper in some partnerships with IES, which when you both did it, it was Institute of European Studies, right? Yes. Now it's the International Education of Students Abroad. And so that's a nonprofit that study abroad program for college students. So I'm planning to donate part of the proceeds of my book to that organization. And then also looking at partnering with another organization which has deep roots here in Denver. It's called the Global Livingston Institute, but it's a nonprofit that's focused on East Africa. And it has a global classroom focus as well, with enabling students, high school students, college students, to have these immersive educational experiences in East Africa and to have a deeper view on international development. So I think that there's a lot that we can do to partner with organizations like that and help. For me, it's continuing to foster that passion that I have.
Cool. Yeah. And also with people who are less, it's a privileged thing to be able to work or study abroad, right? So making Absolutely. That available the way you're doing that is awesome. So, and yeah. Brandy, sorry.
Yeah, no, I was going to jump in and talk about sort of the different end of the spectrum and talk about some of the local businesses that we engaged with on our travels. In general, we were trying to work with as many local folks as possible. It felt like it's more authentic than your money's going back into the community, things like that. But there were two in particular that jumped out. And one was in Nepal. We hiked the Annapurna base camp, which is about a 12-day trek. And so you need guides and porters and all that kind of stuff. It's not, you know, you're not rope climbing, you're on trails the whole time, but you know, they help you through all of this. And we went with a group called Three Sisters, which is based out of Pokhara, which is an all women run organization. So women leaders, women guides, women porters. And so that was important to us, partially to show our daughters sort of the range of possibilities that are out there. But it's also, it was interesting talking for even just to the porters who, we had two porters who carried, I think they carried about 15 kilos each for us. And they, you know, learning a little bit on the trip about their backgrounds, you know, this was the first chance they'd ever had to earn cash, to earn money. Everything right. else, they came from these, you know, farming families, and, you know, they're farming everywhere in Nepal, but it's on, you know, slopes that are, you know, 45 degrees. It's really intense terrace farming and it's hard work. But they were the first people in their families who'd ever earned cash. Otherwise it was, you know, you have your goats and you have your milk and you take it to the market and you barter for it. It's very, you know, it almost feels like something from 300 years ago here. And so these organizations sort of help locals raise themselves up through work. And so that type of stuff I think was really important to
us. And they have education programs on female women empowerment, mm-hmm. which is yep. amazing.
Yeah. And there was another group in New Delhi run by this guy, Pradeep. It's called Delhi by Locals. And so what he does is he ties together, you know, New Delhi city tours. In the end, he helped us plan our entire Northern India itinerary, mm-hmm. But also ties it into work he's doing in some of the slums there in New Delhi, where, you know, you're giving back to the educational system that he's building there. And our kids engaged with the kids there, just, you know, spend a day playing chess, you know, doing dances, being silly with each other, but sort of building that connection in a way you realize you're like, you know, they're just kids.
They're almost,
yeah. Yeah. That kind of stuff was really neat. So I'd say the role of small business in some of these communities can really make a big difference. Love that.
So last question for both of you. We've covered so much. You've shared a lot of insights, but do you have any other pearls of wisdom you'd share with folks listening to this or watching this program about leading a purpose-driven life or a purpose-driven career?
Yeah, here, I'll jump in on that. I think from my point of view, it's very easy to go through life sometimes on autopilot. I would encourage folks to take a step back every now and then and just think about what you're doing and try to, I'd say, our goal is to operate with intention. And intention can mean something very different for every individual. Mm-hmm. But life is short. Don't let it pass you by. You know, make an intent and then do what you can to follow through on it. The world's a big, beautiful complex, but I'd say my takeaway I can say is it's a good place. Like you hear in the news about all the crappy stuff that happens, but you know, one of our friends back here asked us after the trip, they're like, well, how many times did you get robbed? And we're like, well, actually never. Like not once. Like we didn't get nothing. Like
just damn scorpion. But other than that,
just the scorpion, exactly. So the world's a good place. People are good. You know, make an intention and then take a risk and go for it. Most likely to work out.
Well, and I love that. And I'll just piggyback off that very briefly to say one of my favorite quotes is by Antonio Machado, and in Spanish it's "Caminante no hay camino, se hace camino al andar." Which just means wanderer, there is no path. We create the path while walking. So to what Randy said, you know, just create your path and go.
Beautiful. Last words. I love that. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been such an honor today and a privilege. We've gone way over time with Andy and Randy Allman talking about their fantastic year abroad with their children, studying, living, experiencing the world. I hope you'll come back. I want to see the book when it's out and maybe even do a book party for you. But thank you
Amazing.
So much.
Thank you so much, Toby. We appreciate
Thanks.
It.
Thank you for listening to The Caring Economy with Toby Usnick. Please share your comments and questions with Toby via Twitter at TUsnick or LinkedIn at Toby Usnick. And thank you for sharing the caring economy with your friends and colleagues.